Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is podcast number 80 for Wednesday, January 11th, 2012. And my name is Ben Stone. Yesterday, I read a thing from L. Neil Smith, and I wanted to start today's podcast off. Well, no, you know, I need to do my disclaimer. Until I get out of this motorhome and get back to normal sound qualities, I need to give a disclaimer. Disclaimer. I'm just making up words now. Okay, so as the last few have, this podcast is coming from my motorhome. We are on the road. We've had family issues. We had a death in the family. And so we're on the road trying to deal with these things rather than making my normal podcast from in my studio. So we have sound quality issues. We have background noises. We have constant interruptions by Baggy the cat and Nicky the dog. We have people coming up to the motorhome and knocking on the door. We have a chicken hatchery behind me. We have railroad tracks. We have a auto body shop and a highway to deal with. So any of these things can cause an interruption in the podcast at any particular time. And all these things seem to end up making their way into the podcast every day. So I apologize for the sound quality. And I actually did apologize. Most people in the United States use that word wrong. Apologize doesn't necessarily indicate sorry. Sorry is one thing, but people use the word apologize to indicate sorry or that there's sorrow involved. The word apologize comes from apology, which has Greek origins, which indicate more to give an explanation or to give a reason for, rather than to show sympathy in regards to. So I both have I both am sorry that the sound quality is bad. And I apologize. And my apology was my explanation. Word geeks. Okay. So yesterday's podcast was sort of a recap of what the purpose of this podcast is, what the purpose of Bad Quaker website and the purpose of BadQuaker.com podcast is. And I wanted to start off today by reading something that I read yesterday by L. Neil Smith. This is in regards to the concept of the non-aggression principle or the zero aggression principle. Quote from L. Neil Smith. A libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right, under any circumstances, to initiate force against another human being or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim. That's L. Neil Smith. Now, of course, that leaves open the opportunity of self-defense, as I discussed yesterday. The libertarian is in no way obliged to be a pacifist. Self-defense is entirely legitimate within the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle. So then let me just clarify this one more time. Being a libertarian, and I wrote an article on this, I've talked about it extensively, but being a libertarian does not mean you're liberal on some issues and conservative on some issues. It simply does not mean that. That is not only inaccurate, it's deceptive. Being a libertarian means consistency in theory and in practice. You are a libertarian if you advocate and follow the non-aggression principle. But if in your life you do not advocate and follow the non-aggression principle, then it doesn't matter what you call yourself. Just like L. Neil Smith said, it doesn't matter what you call yourself. You're simply not libertarian. So it's not a political way of thinking. You can't look at something and say, how do you feel about abortion? How do you feel about gun rights? How do you feel about the economy? How do you feel about the Federal Reserve? And and then go point by point on these and deal with them as hot button issues the way the left and the right want you to do. Because what we have to go back to is, what does the zero aggression principle have to say about this? If you take the question of the Federal Reserve and you say, well, what is your position on the Federal Reserve? Should the Federal Reserve be audited? Should the Federal Reserve be abolished? Well, here's the real question. Does the Federal Reserve aggress upon individuals? Does the Federal Reserve use aggressive force, initiate force, or do they advocate it, or do they delegate its initiation? Well, let's see. If I decide that I want to trade purely in banana skins, what will the Federal Reserve ultimately end up doing with me? If I'm, let's say I'm Ford Motor Company, and I decide that tomorrow I will no longer accept Federal Reserve notes, I will only accept banana skins. What do you think the Federal Reserve, what will their reaction to this be? And, of course, their reaction would be to take legal aggression against me using the force of the government. So the Federal Reserve, then, uses the force of government to maintain a monopoly in the monetary system using Federal Reserve notes. Therefore, the Federal Reserve initiates aggression. They do so by utilizing their relationship with the federal government. So, how do I feel about an audit of the Federal Reserve? It'd probably be nice, but ultimately, the existence of the Federal Reserve is a violation of the non-aggression principle or the zero aggression principle. So you don't look at things in this simplistic right or left. Do you support this policy? Do you support that policy? You don't look at it like that. You look at it through the lens of how is this problem addressed through the non-aggression principle or through the zero aggression principle. So now, yesterday I also was talking about Stefan Molyneux's universally preferable behavior. And my statement was that I look at it far more simply. Stefan puts so much mental effort into thinking everything out to its finest details and points, and I thank him for that, and that's absolutely necessary for someone in his position of being a philosophical, looking at things through philosophy. But I'm a gardener. You know, so I look at things in far more simple terms. I think about things like I was talking about yesterday, how the ants and the aphids interact on my grape leaves. And I come to an understanding of natural law not through a series of logical processes that drive me to certain conclusions based on strictly scientific methods that of psychology that are not psychology, but of philosophy that drive Stefan Molyneux, but a far more simplistic method. So that when I look at it, I think every animal naturally does that which is in its own best interest to survive. Humans, on the other hand, abandoned natural law when we chose to make laws above and beyond what nature has provided for us. So in other words, when mankind chose to ignore what is our natural tendencies and natural law, which, by the way, is the zero aggression principle that I was just mentioning, when man chose to ignore that and man chose to utilize aggression to force other humans to behave in the way that he wants them to behave, this was the birth of the state. This was the creation of the state. And when man takes it upon himself to be the lawgiver, man causes himself to take on the position of creator. Because whatever created us, be it if you think of a creator God, or if you think of naturalistic processes that produced us, however we got here, whatever processes that it took to get us to where we are today, those processes or that creator or whatever it is that got us to where we are did so utilizing the natural laws that are convenient to us. But when we take it upon ourselves to write new laws and try to use aggression to enforce those laws upon other humans, then we take ourselves out of anything that any other animal does. We violate the very laws of nature when we do this. Now, any animal, and it doesn't matter what animal, but any animal that begins to act outside of natural law does so at the risk of its own species, or at least of its own life. When a large group of animals begin acting outside of the scope of their natural abilities and their natural laws that govern them, they run the risk of extinction. In the case of humans, if you think about the state, and the state is what we have created when we decided to make man's laws God rather than nature's laws. So as we created a God for ourselves, as we created a new nature, so to speak, in the form of the state, and we allow the state to be that thing which creates and creates laws and regulates our behavior, when we do that, we set up a different future than we would if we just allowed ourselves to follow the non-aggression principle. And so then if we think about the state, and what is the state capable of, what's the direction the state is going, what history has the state had, what has it produced for us so far? Well, the state did not produce the wheel. The state did not produce fire. The state did not teach us to flake pieces of flint into blades. The state did none of these things. The state did not figure out how to smelt a metal out of rock. The state didn't figure those things out. Individuals figured all those things out long before there was a state. The state did not figure out how to dig a hole in the ground and plant selected seeds so that crops are there in a more dependable fashion than the wild has given us. The state didn't figure that out. Humans figured that out before the state existed. What has the state brought us? The state has brought us theft, destruction, lies. This is all the state can ever do, because the state is based on aggression, deception, and theft. Without theft, without aggression, and without lies, there would be no state. So then what is it that the state produces? Again, the state does not produce products. The state does not do anything positive for the marketplace. The state hinders invention. The state tends to stop all forward progress. The state destroys. Take a look at Nagasaki. Take a look at Dresden. Take a look at Sarajevo. Take a look at London. People build things up and the state destroys. People create wealth and the state destroys it. Some it steals, but mostly the state destroys. The state is a vehicle for theft in the sense that some people utilize the state in order to fill their own pockets with the wealth of other people. But as much as the state steals and redistributes, the state destroys far more. And the bigger the state gets, the more it destroys. For example, you take World War II as one example. During World War II, states around the world, but the state as a whole being really one single entity, even though there were numerous governments represented, but the state as a whole, it distracted people's attention from their own lives and their own families and their own production. It forcibly took people away from jobs that were creating things, wealth and goods and services, and forced some of those people to create weapons and bombs and vehicles of destruction. And at the same time, the state forced some people to take up those arms and those vehicles of destruction. And when a fleet of airplanes flew over a city in Eastern Europe and bombed and destroyed a 1,000-year-old city in Eastern Europe, the result is not just the obvious of the destruction of a 1,000-year-old city. It is that, but it's not just that. The state has done far more than that in this act. The state has actually destroyed all the wealth that had been built up over 1,000 years in that city, but it also destroyed the wealth of the people who were working in the factories back far, far away from there that built the airplanes and built the bombs and built all the equipment that it took to get all those flyers in those planes bombing that city. You see, if I have 40 hours to work, and I can take my 40 hours and I can, let's say I work in a factory for 40 hours and I produce refrigerators, then the product of my work, my production, goes into a market where people use the refrigerators in order to preserve foods so that their food lasts longer, and in the long run their life improves because of this. In a sense, they're wealthier because they can preserve their food and not have it go bad quite as quickly. So by me working my 40 hours in the refrigerator factory, I'm adding to the wealth of not only myself in the hourly sense that I get paid, but I'm also adding to the wealth of whoever eventually buys the refrigerator and utilizes it to preserve their goods. So working in a factory making refrigerators adds to wealth. But when I work that same 40 hours in a factory making bombs, and then those bombs go and blow up a city in Eastern Europe, and we're focusing just on World War II because this is an easy one to pick on, what I've done is not only has my labor, 40 hours, gone into a device that's going to destroy wealth, but because the 40 hours were spent creating a wealth-destroying device, they were not creating a refrigerator. So not only am I denying the wealth of the people that my bomb is destroying, I'm denying the wealth of the people who would have benefited from the refrigerator. So in addition to that, I got paid the 40 hours to build the bombs. And where did the money come from to pay me 40 hours to build bombs? It was stolen out of the pockets, aggressively, by force. It was stolen out of the pockets of somebody else who was doing some other productive job. Somewhere somebody has to be growing some corn or producing some refrigerators or doing something that supports society. There has to be someone somewhere that's still working to support the factory worker who makes the bomb, who blows up the city. And you're stealing the wealth from the factory worker that could have gone back into the system to produce more wealth, but it didn't. It went into the system to produce a bomb that went in and destroyed part of a city. So this is what the state does. Now, if someone at this point takes on the argument that, well, you're using World War II as an example, but we had to fight World War II, otherwise the evil Nazis would have taken over the world. Well, we have a bigger problem there. First off, it was the state fighting. It was the state aggressing. If you want to point at Adolf Hitler, then he was functioning within the state. If you want to make the Imperial Japanese as the bad guys, well, they were functioning as the state. Hitler was functioning as the state. Stalin was functioning as the state. Mussolini was functioning as the state. So the state started the fight. the state got other governments involved in the fight, and the state is the only one that benefited from the fight. Who benefited from World War II? Certainly not the German people. Certainly not the American people that dumped their wealth into it. Who benefited from World War II? Again, the question will come back. Oh, but we had to do this. The evil Hitler. Oh, the evil Nazis. Oh, the evil fascists. Back up. The state was the evil Nazis and the evil fascists. Hitler was acting on behalf of the state. So see the picture bigger than just your local government. They're just one tiny tentacle of this giant, hideous beast. What you see in your government is just simply one puppet. You got to look past them and you got to see the puppet master. The puppet master is that state that we create when we decide in our minds that some men can make laws and use the aggression of the state to enforce those laws upon us. When we make that choice in our mind and we say that the state is justified in doing these things because it's the state, we have abandoned natural laws and we have taken on the state as our creator, as our God, as our lawmaker, as our source. Okay, so now that was kind of just a little bit of a long, rambling 20-minute recap of yesterday's. Are these becoming sermons? I certainly hope not. I don't want them to be. When I edit this and listen to it, I'll try to be a little critical of myself and see if I'm sounding like I'm doing sermons. And if I am, I'll try to do what I can to shift my direction and make them not a sermon. Okay, now I did want to talk about something that happened that I watched yesterday. All the fun election stuff with those rascally Republicans. They're up in New Hampshire, and Breitbart TV was up there with one of their reporters and one of their camera crews. And they were at one of the, I can't remember, one of the tax eaters rally of some kind. And there was some Ron Paul supporters that were nearby. And the reporter was, there's a YouTube of this. I'll link to it. I'll put the YouTube link on the badquaker.com website where this file appears. But in the YouTube video, and this is available on Breitbart on their YouTube channel, by the way. I think it says something about some Ron Paul supporters trolling. I believe it uses the word trolls or trolling the, I think it's a Santorum, whatever that guy's name is. Some tax eater. I mean, they're all the same anyway. The best way to get to it is just to go to badquaker.com and look for this file and or look for this page and just click on the link, and then there you are. So they're in New Hampshire, and the Breitbart, they're all part of the state. Yes, and I failed to mention this yesterday. When we're talking about the tentacles of the state, we're talking about the corporate world is a puppet of the state, the banking industry, the banking of, I should say specifically, fractional reserve and central banking is a tentacle of the state, is a puppet of the state. Governments are simply a puppet of the state. Individual governments are not the state. They're puppets of the state when they choose to use the aggression of the state to enforce themselves upon people rather than being a voluntary government. And the news media, the mainstream media, is a puppet of the state. It is a tentacle of the same beast. Okay, so anyway, so the Breitbart people were there, or however you pronounce that thing. And got to see Brad Jardis was there with the other Ron Paul supporters. It was fun to see him. In the video, the reporter first is confused about the bus that's there because he sees that the bus has a Ron Paul sign on it, and he assumes it's an official Ron Paul activity. You see, this is one thing about the Ron Paul supporters. It really it confuses these reporters because they expect all these Ron Paul people to be paid staff, just like the Romney people and just like the Gingrich people and just like these others. They expect all Ron Paul people at these events, and they expect to see, whenever they see a bus with Ron Paul on it, whenever they see a sign somewhere, they expect this to all be campaign money that's doing this, official campaign money. So the reporter goes over there expecting to see official, real, live Ron Paul campaign staff. And what he finds instead is just some people. And so he's a little confused, and he's talking about, well, this is part of the Ron Paul super PAC, right? And they're trying to explain. It's like, no, we're just people. We're not anything. We're just people. But the reporter really didn't catch on, you know, because he's already assumed in his mind who he's talking to. So then the reporter brings up the idea that the Ron Paul campaign essentially is an anti-war campaign, which is somewhat simplistic, a little bit of a straw man, but not too far off. I mean, that's an aspect of what they're doing. So the reporter decides to do what reporters do. And that is throw out a series of gotcha questions and see if he can't cause these people to look like fools. So he throws out the question. He says, what happens when we pull the troops out of South Korea? And the first person that he sticks the microphone in front of gives the simple, honest answer. We save money. That's, you know, yeah, that's, there you go. What happens when we pull all the troops out of South Korea? We save money. It's pretty much that simple. Now, of course, our Mr. Statist, our Mr. Puppet of the state, immediately stands up his straw man and has already leaped to a series of ridiculous positions in the argument, but we'll get to that. And so the reporter says, okay, but what about the lives of the South Koreans? Like, okay, now, first off, so let me just address this for a second. These simple-minded, idiotic reporters actually believe, and would like for us to believe, that one of the poorest countries in the world, North Korea, that can barely feed its own soldiers, literally does not have enough guns to have each of its soldiers holding a gun. A country that lives entirely off the aid of other countries because it simply cannot make enough food to feed its own people. A country who's having serious population problems, I might add. This country that is so poor that if you look at it on the... Go to Google and Google... let's see, what would you call that? Something like, I'll just go over there and try it and see. World at night. Yeah. If you just go to Google and Google the words world at night and hit the image button there for images. And what you'll see is some aerial photographs or actually from space. Oh, you know what? It's offering one to me. World at Night Korea. Yeah. Do that. Google World at Night Korea in Google Images. And look at what you're seeing here. You see a peninsula, the Korean Peninsula. And there is a very solid dividing line. And the south is entirely industrialized. And there are huge major cities all lit up. And in the north, you see essentially one light. And that's probably the Imperial Palace. The rest of the north pretty much is in the dark. They are essentially living a life that might be considered pretty common for the 1800s. Now, who really believes that a country, a poor, extremely poor country, can afford to attack its extremely rich, heavily populated neighbor? Let's just assume that the North would be so stupid as to attack the South. And somebody might say, oh, well, but they've got a crazy leader. Ah, he died! Your evil boogeyman that was in the North for so long, he's dead. Who are we supposed to be afraid of now? His son? Are we supposed to believe that his son is also an evil boogeyman that we should constantly be in fear of? This country that's so poor that they literally can't feed themselves, and the whole world is supposed to be afraid of them? So if they were to attack the South, how would they feed their marching army? How would they equip their marching army? And why is it that the South, being one of the richest countries in the world, can't defend itself? If South Korea, being one of the richest countries in the world, can't defend themselves, what obligation do we have? What obligation do we have to protect the South if they're unwilling to protect themselves? If this threat of North Korea is so bad that the South is actually at threat of being attacked, what obligation do we have to protect them if they are unwilling to protect themselves? So, getting back to our not-so-bright reporter, he gives the question, okay, what about the lives of the South Koreans? And then the reporter goes on to attempt to educate the guys that are there about Korea. Because here's the thing about reporters, and you watch and see if you don't realize this is the case. Most reporters think that they know more about topics than the average person. On the other hand, if you really watch reporters, they're not that bright. They're really not. The few that I have met were not bright at all. And the ones that I watch on TV, and especially if you watch the morning sit around and drink coffee type news programs, those people are idiots. They are really, really, they have a shallow outlook on life. And it doesn't matter, the ones on Fox and the ones on CNN and the ones on any other channel, the ones leaning more to the left or the ones leaning more to the right, they're all very shallow people. Okay, so in the video again, as the reporter tries to educate the guys that are there about the situation in Korea, there's one of the Ron Paul supporters there, the guy I'm going to call the guy with his hands in his pockets, because I'm sorry, but I don't know all the names of all the liberty activists in New Hampshire. Anyway, the guy with his hands in his pockets, he says, we are separated by oceans, and this is not an exact word-for-word quote, but I'm going to try to get the brunt of what he's trying to indicate. He said, we are separated by oceans, so why do we have to use our money for them? Now, this is a perfectly valid point. Why should we pay to protect those guys? There's a giant ocean there. North Korea is not a threat to us in any way. And the reporter then shifts the argument, and it goes into a discussion. This discussion kind of fades about funding war and what is constitutional war. Was the Korean War, should it have been fought? Was it okay to fund it? Should there be, and all this is really kind of, Brad jumps in at that point and he makes some really good points, but, there's some problems that you're going to face anytime you're dealing with someone like this. And so now here's the point. Here's really my point in bringing up this video. Not only is it fun, it's a fun video, it's an educational video, and it's fun to see Brad on a Breitbart video. That was a good occasion too. But the real reason that I'm talking about it today is because As much as I would like to be up there in New Hampshire with you guys, I'm stuck in Missouri in a motorhome. So I hope you guys take it the way that I want this to come across. I'm not here to criticize your handling of this reporter. I liked your handling of the recorder. I liked the video in general. But, you know, I'm an old guy. I've been in this game for a long time. And so if I might impose myself, if I might offer myself, not really impose, if I might offer myself with some coaching, some voluntary coaching that you can accept voluntarily or you can ignore if you choose. You know, but I'm old. I've been around the block a few times. And so consider this coaching advice from me. The guy with his hands in his pockets uses the absolute correct method in dealing with this. What you need to do when you're asked the reporter is presenting you with a question that's not based on principles. We let's look at it this way. A principled position, for example, I was talking about the zero aggression principle earlier. A principled position takes a stand that says, this is, you get back to first principles. I've talked about first principles before. You take something down to a point of where it can no longer be shifted in any other direction, and you have an absolute. Like, for instance, it's a principle that people act. How do you know that people act? Well, because I just said the words people act, and in doing that, that was an act. And you asked me back, how do I know that people act? Well, when you ask that, you acted. Therefore, it's a principle that people act. See, that's a first principle. And so when you work this thing out in your mind, and you get to the point of where you're going to ask somebody a question, and this is from the reporter's point of view, the reporter's going to ask a question like, okay, what about the lives in South Korea? Well, that's not a principled question. That's a question based on temporary wants, temporary desires, or emotions, you see. It's not based on any actual principle. There's no guarantee of any kind that if we pulled the troops out of Korea, that there would be any violence or that there would not be any violence. There's no guarantee one way or the other on that. This is entirely a matter of conjecture as to whether or not there would be violence. So he's making an assumption based on that conjecture and then taking that assumption and bringing the question out as if that assumption were a fact. Well, if we pull everybody out, if we pull all the troops out of South Korea, North Korea will immediately invade and they'll kill everybody in South Korea. It's a ridiculous point. But he's already placed that as a truth in the question when he questions it. So when presented with an unprincipled question, the very most efficient, best way to handle that is to present the questioner with a principled question. And the gentleman with his hands in his pocket, he kind of did that. When presented with the question, what about the lives in South Korea? He presented the question back. We're separated by oceans. That part answered the question about what should we do about this. We're not threatened. We're separated by oceans. Why should we use our money to protect them? See, now we're going back to a principled question. Why should we rob people in the United States to protect people in South Korea that are unwilling to pay for their own protection? You see, now you've taken an unprincipled question and you've put it back to, you didn't, don't worry about answering. Never worry about answering an unprincipled question. It's a no-win situation when you attempt to answer an unprincipled question. So when presented with an unprincipled question, immediately put a principled question back to them. And this is taking advantage of something called the Socratic method. Using the Socratic method, what you are attempting to do is you present a principled question to someone in a way so that they can self-examine, or so that they're forced to self-examine before they answer it. So in this situation, what the hands in his pocket guy did was, by presenting it back to the reporter, why should we pay? Again, I'm butchering the actual words that he uses, but I'm trying to get across his point, which his point was absolutely valid. Why should Americans be taxed and pay money to protect South Koreans who are unwilling to pay the money to have their own military? That's the principled question. And given that, of course, in this case, the reporter just let it pass right by, because he's not about to, be baited into thinking. A reporter's not going to do that. He's not going to let you make him think. So what the reporter is going to try to do is go back to a goal-based perspective, or a goal-based question. That's what I was referring to a minute ago when I said a question that's not principle-based is one that's based on temporary wants and temporary desires or emotions. So a goal-based question, like the one about what about the lives and what about the Korean lives? Well, that's goal-based. Your goal being that you have either temporary wants or desires, or emotions. It's, you know, the fear. Oh no! If we're not there, the evil North Koreans will just overrun the South and kill them all. They'll kill the babies. Think of the children. That's all, you know, fear-based, emotional-based, goal-based questioning. And so, as soon as the goal-based questions are presented, just ignore them and put right back to the questioner a principled question, using the Socratic method. Make them think about the principle involved, not the result, not the desire, not the emotion, not the temporary needs. Now, the other thing, and the reporter in this case is, of course, he's a professional at this, so this is what he does for a living. He has to, in order to control the interview, which is his job, he has to control the conversation. So he will continually try to shift the conversation back to his goal-based point of view and his goal-based questions. But you have to gain control of the conversation. Always control the conversation. This is a technique in sales. If you are attempting to sell something to someone, it's imperative that you control the conversation. And the other end of that is, if someone is trying to sell you something, it's imperative that you control the conversation. Because if you let the salesman control the conversation, you will not get the best deal. And from the salesman point of view, if you don't control the conversation, you won't get the best sale. You see, controlling the conversation is the key whenever there's a negotiating event going on. And it's the same when you're arguing a principled point of view against a goal-based point of view. You have to control the conversation. Otherwise, it'll just go into, a series of, the next thing you know, you'll be trying to justify why, you know, with war, it always goes back to the boogeyman is going to come kill your children if you don't go do these things. It always does. Okay, so now, in the situation where, in this video with the reporter, the Ron Paul people had an advantage, and that is that there was a bunch of them, and they were all pretty much, you know, the fact that they're Ron Paul supporters, I'm going to assume that they all have at least somewhat of a principled approach to the way that they're thinking. Because that tends to be the case with Ron Paul supporters as opposed to, you know, Ron Paul supporters as opposed to, I'm tangling all up on my words. I know what the problem is. We haven't had a train eruption. Anyway, so I lost my train of thought there. So, but the key is in controlling the conversation. And when you have a team like that, you have a group of people, like the group of Ron Paul supporters there, and you're only dealing with one reporter. Now, I realize there's camera people and there's a mic person and all this kind of thing, but essentially, the reporter is going to present himself as one person dealing with all these people he's interviewing. So you've got the advantage of having a team. Now, a team will always work best if it has a natural leader as its spokesman. And that one person can take over the conversation and continue reiterating principled questions while the other people in the team answer those questions. Okay, so we actually did have an interruption. It wasn't a train, but we did have an interruption. So now Baggy is active and Nikki is active. Okay, so we'll see if we can pick this back up and get past the interruption there. Again, that's the problem with podcasting out in the motorhome. Of course, if I was at home in the studio and being interrupted, then I'd have some other excuse for that. But okay, anyway. So the advantage of working in a team. You have one or two lead people who can re-question with principled questions and continue to attempt to keep the conversation in control, while the rest of the team can actually answer those questions. So that, for instance, hands in his pocket guy, he says, why, essentially, in whatever words that he chooses, why should people in the United States be forced to pay taxes to pay for the protection of people in South Korea when they won't pay the taxes to protect themselves? And then rather than pausing and allowing the reporter to, rather than assuming he's honest and actually cares about the question, or rather than assume that he has the intellect to understand the question, remember it's being recorded, and the people who you really want to win is not necessarily that doofus reporter, but it's anybody who sees this after it's released. You see, that's who your real audience is. It's not necessary to convince the half-wit reporter. What is necessary is to take every opportunity to get the message out to as many people as possible. So never think, when two people are in confrontation in public over one of these issues like this, never think that your goal is to change the mind of the person you're speaking to. Always keep in mind your goal is for those who are listening. And the guy who's arguing with you probably isn't listening. So then, always try to keep control of the conversation. Use one or two primary people with natural leadership ability to try to regain control of the conversation each time the reporter attempts to gain control back again. And the other thing, the Socratic method, always keep it on a questioning level, presenting principled questions back to the reporter. It doesn't matter what he asks you. Ask him back a principled question. Do not answer the reporter's question. It will always be an "I gotcha" question. And later on in the video, there's a veteran near the end. And he nails it. He exposes the reporter. He says, "You know, you keep throwing these gotcha questions at us." And the reporter's like, "What? Me? What gotcha question?" And what the reporter actually is doing is throwing the question right back to the vet. See, he's using the method that I'm talking about. He's attempting to regain control of the conversation by throwing another question back at you. But the vet had it precisely right. Everything the reporter said was an attempt at a gotcha moment. Now, I've talked about these before. In earlier podcasts, I've talked about never, never answer an I gotcha question. Never do it. There's no way to, I mean, I could think of a dozen I gotcha questions to ask somebody, and going into it, I know they should not answer these questions. Because the point, again, is not to convince the questioner or the answerer. The point is to bring the message out to those observers who are going to watch it. That's really your audience. So the reporter understands that. So the reporter just throws it right back at the veteran. But never answer a gotcha question. Principled counter questions trump gotcha questions every time. Gotcha questions often indicate a simplistic view or an insecure view of the problem. So never try to answer them. Okay, now at the end of the interview, there's one major mistake that takes place, and I had to point this out. At the end of the interview, the reporter attempts to marginalize the guys by asking them leading questions, giving the impression that they're so-called truthers or conspiracy nuts, that kind of a thing. Now, this has nothing to do with what the guys actually believe. You see, remember, he's not asking them a question to get anything out of them other than entertainment for his viewers. So he's not really going for the truth. He's going for an I gotcha. He doesn't want to really know your opinion about these things. So he's going to ask you questions that can't be fully answered in a one or two sentence answer. He does that for a reason. That's why they do these things, so that they can get you and they can paint you to be some kind of conspiracy nut. Now, this last part that I'm about to say should have been the first part, but I kept it to here intentionally. So you might be able to say that this last thing should have been the first thing. Never talk to mainstream media casually. Never. If they approach you like they did these guys in this video, if they approach you, don't speak with them under their terms. Because they're professionals. If you were going to fight Mike Tyson, or if you were going to fight Jackie Chan, or if you were going to fight anybody else like that, if you were going to fight Mike Tyson, would you do so in a ring wearing gloves and shorts with a referee and a guy with a bell? Or would you sneak up behind him with a board? You see? The same thing with Jackie Chan. If you're gonna fight Jackie Chan, would you do so in a street in downtown Hong Kong with a lot of baskets and ladders and doodads all around? Would you fight Jackie Chan like that? Or would you fight Jackie Chan by sneaking up to him when he's asleep and putting a gun against his head? I mean, that might not even be safe. But you see my point. You never fight someone who is already a professional at this particular game. You never take on, if I was going to have an athletic competition with, I was going to use somebody famous like a tennis player, and the person whose face I had in mind, I can't remember their name. But if I was going to have an athletic competition, or if I was going to have some kind of competition with a famous tennis player, I would see to it that we were having a competition that involved something more along the lines of football or soccer. I wouldn't try to compete against them in tennis because that's their specialty. And it's the same thing when you're dealing with a reporter. This is their job. They may be an idiot, like I'm saying earlier. Most reporters are. They may be simple-minded. Yes, I know. But it's still their job. You go around some Golden Gloves boxers. You might be around low-level Golden Glove boxers. Unless you know how to box pretty good, don't step into the ring with them. Because even if you're a big, strong guy, you're going to get a surprise. Now, that's pretty much the same with anybody who specializes in something. And reporters specialize in what they do. So for that reason, never talk casually to the mainstream media. Never. Our best options in the Liberty Movement are to use the media that we control. If you have to talk to the mainstream media, do so in a setting that you control, like a press release. Otherwise, you end up looking like the guy in the trailer court wearing the wife beater t-shirt with the mullet and the Camaro behind him sitting on cement blocks. Because that's what they want you to look like. That's what they want to bait you into looking like. That's their job. That's what they do. And they're good at it. They're good at setting aside all the principled questions, relying strictly on emotions, strictly on desires, temporary wants. This is what the mainstream media feeds their people. And so they don't really want the truth. They don't. When they ask you a question, it's not because they want to know the truth. Any time the mainstream media asks you a question, it's for the purpose of baiting you into looking like a fool. That's what they're doing. That's their job. That's why the state employs them. Okay, folks. Again, I don't want you to take this as though, you know, I'm. Criticizing anyone. I'm just an old guy who's lived a long life, and maybe some of the things I've experienced, maybe some of you can utilize these things. For more on the Socratic method, I'm going to put a link on today's podcast in the notes to Jan Helfield. Jan irritates some people, and sometimes he's a little difficult to listen to, but I'm going to put a link to his YouTube channel, or at least to one of his YouTubes. Get over there and watch several of Jan Helfield's YouTube videos, and get over to his website. He has a really good teaching series on using the Socratic method. And he's, there's some roughness there and there's some problems, but he's really good at displaying how this thing works and how to get somebody into a position where they're forced to either deal with the question, look like a fool, or run away or get mad, which they actually do in some of Jan's videos. They get really mad and even attack him. So for more on the Socratic method, go to Jan Helfield. But for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? You're going to go to badquaker.com, aren't you? Thanks, folks. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.